Welcome everyone to our second episode of the Data Spaces podcast. It's been a while, but we're back. And this time round, we're going to be talking about citizen developers and the rise of low-code, no-code tools. And our guest today is Victor Kupers from Betty Blocks, the VP of Strategy and Citizen Development Expert. And today we're going to be talking about what citizen developers are, how they came about, what they mean for the future of development, and so on. So my first question, Victor, is please could you introduce yourself very briefly and then we can start chatting about citizen developers.
Yes, of course, Tuana. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Really looking forward to it, to this conversation. So I'm a citizen development expert at Betty Blocks, which means that I make sure that our platform tailors to citizen developers and that we allow them to join the application development process without having too much knowledge of how to program an application, in short. So you can imagine that that needs a lot of hard work, deliberation on how to do that, and that's my job at Betty Blocks.
Cool. And if we were to take a step back, could you please explain to us what citizen developers are? What do we mean by this term?
So we usually refer to citizen developers as people that run into problems constantly during their daily jobs. And they are the ones that are really thinking about how can I solve this? And how can I solve this myself? Because I understand this problem. I have to deal with this problem on a daily basis, and it affects me the most that IT doesn't have any space or room in their backlog to help me with this problem. So I'm on my own. I need to fix this myself. And I think that is what is typically referred to as a citizen developer. That person doesn't need to have any knowledge around how to build an application to solve their own problem, but because they experience that problem every day, they know the specifics of the problem, and if they can translate that in a way into an application that doesn't need any programming, they are able to solve their problems quicker, faster, and more efficient.
All right, so clearly this has meant that we have had to think of new ways to build these tools to cater to citizen developers. So if we were to take a historical approach, what has this meant for the way we build these new tools? How have we come about to decide what to provide to citizen developers?
Yeah, that is a very, very interesting question. So in terms of history, I'd like to believe that everybody is or can be a citizen developer, because the most effective people usually solve their own problems. And that has been the case for many, many years in industries like marketing, where marketeers needed to solve their own problems because they weren't getting any attention from IT. So in order to build their own campaigns, they were they needed to solve it themselves. And that's why they started building their own websites, starting to build applications to run their campaigns, to plan them, to make sure that they hit the right audience, and automate this step by step by step. And in order, or the way that they did that was actually being a citizen developer. Because IT wasn't going to help them out to create a website, or they didn't allow them to change the pages or the content on the pages. And by starting to own these own tools, or starting to create their own tooling, they eventually could break away from IT's supervision and build their own tooling. And that's what we've been seeing for the last couple of years, that way of thinking is translated to what we can call the regular workforce. So the people that are behind desks, doing repetitive tasks that aren't updated, have become obsolete, or aren't meeting IT standards anymore. But IT cannot fix them because they have heavier things to do. And you see that that mindset of, okay, now I need to build this myself, or I need to own this process myself, and I need to turn it into an application, is becoming a mindset that is growing in the enterprise. And that's what we've seen historically, what is happening now.
All right, so correct me if I'm wrong, but all of this sounds like there's a very close tie with citizen developers and the rise of no-code and low-code tools. So from my understanding is IT and software engineers are generally very busy maintaining a product and keeping it afloat. And if we have a problem we want to solve or a task we want to do and you do it once, more often than not, you can continue doing it in the same way without necessarily repeating yourself, which gives rise to the tools, what we call no-code, low-code tools. Would you say the rise of citizen developers has meant that there are more and more no-code, low-code tools, or the fact that we've built no-code, low-code tools has given room for more and more citizen developers to exist? How do these two things tie in to each other?
Yeah, great question. I think it is a mix of both. So on the one hand, we see the rise of tooling that enables people in the enterprise to start building their own applications. But on the other hand, because of the way that software has become way more accessible to anyone, I mean, it's even becoming accessible in schools, universities, you learn how to program, you learn how to think, you learn how to model data, etc., etc. People come to expect that they can build things themselves. So on the one hand, you have the fact that we're providing that need with a tooling that is continuously pushing the boundaries of what is possible and showcasing that to citizen developers. Look, this is what you can. But on the other hand, the pull from citizen developers that say, hey, I expect this to be easy and it's not possible yet. Please provide me with a tool that allows to do just that. And I think that combination, that is what's really pushing this market forward. And that's what's so exciting to be in this space.
Cool. Now I want to sort of play the devil's advocate here and ask you some of the more hard-hitting questions, especially I think questions that developers would be curious about. Is there a line at which no-code becomes a barrier for the task at hand? Can you give us some examples of those?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there's so we're abstracting away difficulty. That's our main job, because we want to make sure that everything that you build is not only in an easy way, but it's also in a composable way or in a repeatable way. Because we believe that once you are able to build an application based on already consisting components, you go faster. And your go-to-market will be faster, and your return on investment will be faster. So that's what we always keep in mind when we develop and try to abstract away all of the difficulties. Are we there yet? No. I think there's a lot of stuff that still needs the mind and the skills of a programmer. But the goal of a no-code and a low-code tool is to minimize the efforts that you need to create something. Still, a lot of stuff still needs to be created for the very first time, and it's not possible via a no-code or low-code platform. And that's where we still need a lot of developers that are building those kinds of tools that you cannot typically easily, fastly build within a low-code and no-code platform. I usually say if it's something that's already been done and it's already been thought of, then it's usually something that you can easily build in a low-code or no-code platform. If it's really a new type of application or a totally new way of working, you might want to do that with code first, because that allows you to have that more flexibility in creating that solution. But once you know how that is done, you can rebuild it in no code and low code and benefit from the fact that you have all these components in place. So usually I get the question, will we get rid of developers by adopting low and no code? And my answer is always, no, we still need the bright people to code. And we still need a lot more of those people, because the challenges we face cannot only be met by low and no code platforms.
Nice. That was cool, because that was actually going to be one of my last questions too. What does this mean for developers? Are we out of jobs? But the this whole concept, I think when we first had a chat about this episode, I also mentioned it. But this whole concept reminds me of the term dry code versus wet code. So it feels like we're transforming the world of development to be more dry, and that means terminology that we don't repeat ourselves over and over again. Which is something we try to avoid when we're structuring our code as well. Cool.
Yeah. And the fun fact is, what I really think is a very good thing, is that our challenges in software are that high. We need all the hands on deck. We need everybody to help. And what I believe what we do with no-code and low-code platforms is that we provide a platform for the business people to engage in software problems that are somewhat mundane. They are not rocket science, but they still need attention. And why not use a low and no-code platform to solve these 80% of your software needs, and then you have that 20% of the software needs that still needs a lot of thinking, attention, bright minds, people throwing their best at it, and that 20% is also still growing. So yeah, all hands on deck.
Nice. And this also, I think, it also means that engineers can focus on the more hard-hitting engineering problems they might have. And I think I read a blog post by you, I think. Actually, I think it was on the Betty Blocks blog. That engineers are spending most of their time keeping the ship afloat. So if there's any way they can avoid repeating themselves and handing over tasks that can be handed over to people with less technical knowledge, that's giving them more time to focus on the more serious engineering issues.
Nice. Yeah, and then the question arises, how do you manage that? How do you govern that? How do you make sure that that platform will not contribute to even more shadow IT? So the term shadow IT means that everything that takes place outside of IT and is not governed or managed by IT. And in fact, that is one of the biggest risks for enterprises, to have data laying around, processes outside of their knowledge that can break, or data that will be on the streets without them knowing. It involves all kinds of risks. And with a platform like a low and or no code platform, you have these guardrails to use in order for those citizen development to start developing in an environment that is governed by IT. So you not only add new types of developers, but you do it in a safe way as well. And it's controlled, it's managed, it's measurable, etc. So I think that contributes to the whole idea of there's a lot of challenges. We're going to add new types of people to the process to counter those problems. And we have a methodology and guardrails in place to make sure that this doesn't explode in our face, as a lot of other software projects have blown up in our face because we couldn't control it. And I think that's the exciting part of this, that you democratize it, but you still have rules and ways to enforce those rules. So, bright future ahead.
Yes, which ties me nicely into the final question I wanted to ask you. Could you shed some light on what you see the future in terms of citizen development and low-code tools?
Yeah, so the future will be that people will come up with solutions that we cannot even think about right now. Because democratizing software development means that you don't have to learn anything else but to understand the platform itself. And if it's a good platform, it allows you to quickly build something that comes out of your mind and quickly give it hand and feet in that platform through an application. And that means that if we do a good job and abstract away all the difficulties to build a good application, then some of the stuff that people will be building based on these platforms is really going to blow our minds. And I always like to think that at some point in time, we will see an application at Betty Blocks from someone we don't know in a faraway country, which we don't even support, maybe. And he or she has built something that we didn't even know was possible with our platform. And I think that is going to be the moment where we realize, okay, now we're getting there. We've abstracted it away on such a level that people are building stuff that we couldn't even think about. So that is, for me personally, what the future looks like. If you ask it one of our clients, like the Dutch National Police, they believe that they can build a citizen development platform that is not only going to be used by their internal developers, but which is also something that they can make available to real citizens. So I was blown away. It means that once the police starts opening up their data or their processes, and they can allow other people to build on top of that, maybe new solutions to track criminals or new solutions to help police with, well, I'm not sure yet what yet, but they are thinking it like that. So it's not only democratizing development within the police force itself. They believe that at some point in time, citizen development will also be available to real citizens. And that's what really excites me, because I haven't had enough time to think about what that would mean yet, but you triggered me to start doing that again, Tuana. Thank you so much. Nice.
And I think us at Kumulayo are also looking forward to a similar type of future in terms of the use of Kumulayo, by opening up data to end users and citizens to actually create their own insights and visualizations as well. And I think we'll be looking into making sure that all of our future platform and features will have this in mind too. Well, thank you very much, Victor. This has been a really nice episode, and I hope we can have some more of these in the future. This has been Tuana, the developer advocate at Kumulayo. Hope you all enjoyed listening to this, and see you next time. Bye.